بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Salam, hello, peace to you all, and welcome to a very special edition of the program, another bonus live stream as we've been doing during the course of the Ramadan war, having a lot of discussions about what's happening, you know, in Iran and the larger region. And, you know, we have a wonderful opportunity today to speak with a fantastic guest who is a returning guest, an old friend. I'm always delighted to be able to welcome Laith Maarouf to the program. Laith, it's great to see you.
Great to see you, Adnan, too. And best wishes to you and your family. It's been a long time. We haven't actually seen each other in person. Inshallah, this summer, if there's no war, I'll pass by Canada. We'll see.
Oh, that would be great. That would be great. Well, you know, I mean, everyone is, I'm sure, familiar with your work, but of course, I do want to highlight that in addition to being a community media, legal, you know, activist, geopolitical analyst and commentator, you are also a founder and kind of one of the key people that you work with in your team for an absolutely indispensable resource for resistance media, Free Palestine TV. And, you know, I wondered, you know, if maybe you could just tell people at the outset the best places where they could go to watch. I know you're on YouTube and maybe you've had like some issues with that, but also, you know, on the web and where especially they can support Free Palestine TV.
Yeah, so our website is freepalestine.video. And from there, you can find all our social media accounts. We're on YouTube, X, Rumble, Telegram, Substack, Instagram, Upscrolled. We were on Patreon, Odyssey, and TikTok, and we were banned on those, although we were told for a long time that somehow Odyssey is better than even Rumble in terms of, you know, censorship. YouTube gave us monetization last month, and it lasted only 1 month. So they just yanked the monetization away from us. I was shocked, actually, at the amount of money that came from the views. There was around 750,000 views last month. And we made around $2,500. So, you know, our budget is around $10,000 a month. So that would have been a big increase, and it would have helped us produce more content, hire more people. But it's really not something that we ever thought that we are going to get. We were surprised even that we were given that monetization. Our viewers are very loyal. Most of them donate directly on our website, freepalestine.video, where people can choose on the donor box which way they want to pay, what currency they want to pay, how often they want to donate. You know, we appreciate people that do a monthly donation because it helps us balance our budget and expect our costs for the months. But I think with all the throttling, with all the shadow banning, with all the blackballing of a lot of the media activists that are in the West, we're still reaching a huge market of people because our voice is authentic, because we are on the ground doing field reporting and or threats and showing people the reality and bringing the voices of our population here to the rest of the world in English. So we're very appreciative of our audience and our donors. And I think we've managed to survive for 2.5 years without the manipulation of the social medias or the possible incomes from them.
Yeah, yeah, alhamdulillah. Well, I just want to encourage again everyone to go. The links are in the, at least to the website and X and so forth, and the YouTube channel, even if it is demonetized. You know, go check those out. The links are in the video description. And of course, people know that it's very necessary. It's so relevant because you're doing, as you say, the on-the-ground reporting that we're not getting in other formats. But I have to say, I love some of the other new kind of specials, like we Zortan Cafe in the series with Dr. Jamal Wakim. I mean, wonderful. I love his analysis, your dialogue, and it seems like he also has an underrated sense of humor as well. So that's really very cool. So everyone go check out that content. And while you're there, while you're we're doing this sort of housekeeping, I just want to remind you, you can like this stream so that it'll get boosted, you know, on the algorithm, and, you know, share it on social media. We're streaming on X as well. You could just retweet it. That's easy enough to do. The last thing I'll just say about fundraising is just I'm running a course this summer online for students in Gaza, and they need internet access and data packages. And we're also hiring TAs to help with the on the ground, you know, assistance and running discussions and so on. In the course, it's a continuing fundraiser. We'll continue to do it. The link is in the chat as well. My course that I'll be teaching them, you know, and in fact, maybe I haven't talked with Laith about this, but we might have to have him make a guest appearance if he's free and able, which is the course is Guerrilla History, Anti-Colonial Resistance, History Theory Practice. And so, you know, there's a lot of resistance media that could be, you know, done and has been done. And who better than this population of students in Gaza to be able to tell us, to be trained in telling their stories, their histories. And I know that is something that was the idea of Free Palestine TV, on the ground reporting, you know, in the West Bank when it was possible to do. So any rate, do check that out. So Laith, anyway, without further ado, I mean, I've been looking forward to this conversation for a long time. I know you're on so many channels, and, you know, people really want to have you on as a guest because you are always offering this kind of unique perspective and analysis combined with detailed on the ground knowledge from in the region. But I wanted to start with just a kind of high level kind of analysis that it's just been occurring to me more and more how different the tactics of waging war between imperialist and colonial war versus the resistance. And, you know, in Gaza, we heard, you know, about all of these tunnels, you know, and they were themselves, the very idea of the tunnel was seen as a threat, as a danger, as something very scary. And certainly we've seen, of course, in other theaters, but now in southern Lebanon, but especially, you know, Iran, which is a nation state that's been preparing, you know, for U.S. and Israeli war and attack for a very long period of time. They have also, of course, developed this infrastructure underground, you know, and so we just keep seeing this repeated pattern. I'm wondering if you have thoughts about in this age of anti-colonial resistance and imperial war, you know, is this the age of the tunnel? You know, like how do we think about the importance and significance of this adaptation that resistance has taken?
Yeah, I mean, we look at the traditional battlefield, military battlefield, and it's three-dimensional. You know, we've got the land, the sea, the air. And what has happened, of course, over the last 100 years is the total domination of this three-dimensional space by the air and naval power of the empire. And this three-dimensional space is also includes in itself airwaves. When we think about propaganda and or control of communication platforms, social media, what have you, the ether. Well, this new strategy that has been adopted, of course, from lessons all the way back to Vietnam, is that the resistance brought in a new dimension to the battlefield, which is subterranean. So although it's still may look 3D, in reality, it's a 4D situation. And this subterranean battlefield the empire has no way possible to dominate it. Their air power cannot tell them what's happening under this ground. And even their electronic technology, warfare of trying to intercept people speaking to find out what's happening, is prohibited on in this dimension. Okay, so it is, I think, at once a very successful military strategy in terms of being able to hide from your enemy and appear whenever you wish from under their feet to fight them. But it's also provide this added cyber warfare and communication and warfare immunity. All right. So that's the major things that we can, objectively draw out of this. Now, when we look at tactically what's happening in this in these battles, the United States has these huge bombs, with them, of course, the Zionist colony, and they're bombing locations around civilian areas to try to destroy the tunnels under. But even the biggest bombs they have are unable to destroy these underground cities in resistance bunkers. So we've now are seeing that anything below nuclear threshold, and most probably even nuclear attack, wouldn't be able to destroy the missile cities that Iran has under, because much of the nuclear usually attack, the explosion goes up and it's not down. So I don't even know how the West is going to try to counter this subterranean warfare strategy that the Axis of Resistance has now perfected. And this is why there is no way in this war, beyond the fact that the Palestinian, Lebanese, and Iranian peoples are stubborn enough and have persistence enough to stay for years to resist, and decades, and at this point, a century. The fact is now, militarily, the United States and the Zionist colony and all the empire as a whole is incapable of defeating the Axis of Resistance.
Yeah, that wonderful analysis. I'm so glad you included also the airwaves war as one of the components and dimension, because I think Iran has, we already saw it during, the kind of videos from resistance groups in Gaza putting out their own, battlefield records and so on. And of course, making their statements and declarations and circulating those to the public on social media where possible. So we've seen that. And of course, that's something Al-Manar TV, did during the course of the Islamic Resistance's combat against the Israeli occupation in southern Lebanon. And so we've seen different stages of, trying to also take the battle to the information war and so on. But with Iran's recent, another quantum leap, with the Lego videos, using the, cultural, the childish cultural, products of the West to then turn it to mock, their enemies, and also, make deep sort of kind of political points in like 2 minutes, a 2 minute funny video, and all some of the anime that they've been doing. But I noticed also, and I'm wondering what you think about this, is that this mocking component, and I know it's something that you've had your own, experiences with that, I know, of like putting out like mocking and demeaning, is that, even Iranian officials and spokespeople, from the Khatm al-Anbiya spokesperson, has been mocking, "You're fired, Trump," or, this thing. Even a martyr, Ali Larijani, I thought he had a very kind of acidic, acerbic, kind of cynical, kind of really nice wit that he used in some of his tweets, also to mock the U.S. What do you think is the kind of component, both broadly, of how they've taken up the level of the Psy War, the disinformation, to circumvent kind of the mainstream media blockade through fun kinds of things, but also the mocking component? It seemed to me they were trying to goad the U.S. into, I don't know what, mistakes, etc. But, you know, what did you think about all of this?
You know, I'm glad that you brought this up. And I think the first thing that we need to understand before we assess Iran's propaganda game right now is look at what has happened already in terms of the propaganda battlefield against the Zionists and the imperialists over the last 2.5 years. There was a dedication by the Palestinian, Lebanese victims of Zionism and imperialism that is unmatched before, in terms of self-recruiting into the propaganda war. So this first line of citizen journalists that on the one hand on the battlefield showed us the crimes of the Zionists and the perseverance of the people, and with them, another army of citizen journalists, mainly the Palestinian, Arab, and Muslim diasporas, that retweeted, reshared, reamplified those voices. That in itself defeated the combined Zionist imperialist propaganda machine in all languages and in all formats. Okay, so the first line is the citizen journalists. The second line that we saw in Palestine and Lebanon is the military resistance media that is unprecedented. The professional videos that came out from the front lines at the risk of life and death, resistance media professionals working with the military media would go out in the front lines, film the activities of the resistance, somehow survive and smuggle themselves back behind enemy lines to the locations where these videos will be edited. And those teams of editors who spent probably the last 2.5 years underground, never seeing the sun, managed to produce this content for us, and then somehow also surpass all the surveillance technologies and so forth, and managed to get those videos out on social media. That in itself is another level of security, intelligence, glorious achievements. Okay? And then we got the third line. Look at this. This is we're not even gotten to Iran yet. We had the third line of professional journalists that are aligned and dedicated their life to support the resistance and the liberation of our people. That includes, of course, journalists in Al-Mayadeen, like martyr Fatima Ftouni, and before her, the other Al-Mayadeen journalist, and journalists like General Ali Shaib, the most important military conflict journalist in the Arabic world, who also was martyred. And of course, the work of people like Free Palestine TV that are journalists that are on the ground of the battle, providing professional journalistic output. Okay? And again, under these crazy conditions of threat of death, threat of jail, and the overwhelming lopsided situation of imperial media dominating the airwaves, is still those journalists achieved the unachievable and humiliated the imperialist professional media. Well, now all of those three layers of media that we talked about, that are resistance, that already have won all the propaganda wars against Zionism and imperialism over the last 2.5 years, those exist in Iran. But added to it, there's a layer that there is a state and a state apparatus of propaganda and state media that is multimedia, that is professional, that is has funding from a state. So, of course, Iran is going to take it to another level. They are going to build on the achievements of the resistance media in the battlefields where there is no state to back it, in Lebanon and in Palestine, and now show us what you can actually do with having a righteous state with resources to put back, put into the media production to even amplify more our citizen journalists, our military media, and our professional liberationist journalists that are out there. So yes, Iran is now taking it to another level, and you can see how the state apparatus, beyond the fact that professional media outlets like Press TV and Hispan TV and Al Alam and others in all the languages that are there coming out of Iran, and the hundreds of radios and TVs and newspapers that are backed by the state of Iran, well, you're seeing the foreign affairs structures of a state like the embassies of Iran using and utilizing their own social media to amplify. And so, yes, right now, the coordinated Iranian military propaganda strategy under all of those restrictions and throttling and what have you is overwhelming the imperialist media industry. Already that imperialist media industry was overwhelmed by the resistance media coming out from the small battlefields of Palestine and Lebanon, and now look at what's happening. There's no way for the imperialists to regain control of the narrative.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's so important to talk about the layered buildup. I mean, and also, a lot of our friends, on the left seem to think that without a state, it's wonderful. You can just, make the world, you're free, and all this. I mean, but we are seeing the way in which an anti-colonial, anti-imperialist state, can harness, even under 47 years of threat, of 8 years of war and attack sponsored by its neighbors and the empire against it, and then, maximum pressure sanctions, many attempts at like these color revolution, subversion, despite all of that, a state, that survives even with all of that is still such an incredible resource in amplifying then, the resistance capability. So I think it's a pretty important lesson and point that, it's built upon this, but then it shows us also the value of having an organized state resource. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about, maybe some general things before we talk a little bit about what's been happening in some of the particular fronts. There's been a lot of, I think there have been some discussions about trying to see or distinguish some groups in analyzing this war geopolitically, talk about difference in aims and goals strategically that Israel may have had versus the U.S. in starting this war, and what they want to see. And I can understand that at some analysis that might make some sense, because we've seen the Israelis being the ones involved in taking a lot of the escalatory steps and in doing some of the false flag attacks and so on. Very often, this is seen as some kind of a difference. The U.S. just was stupid and got kind of pulled into this. They misled Trump because he's dumb and all of, so there's this kind of like attempt to distinguish. But as we go forward, it seems like that kind of space of difference is really evaporating, both in terms of tactics of imperialist war and also, what the kind of outcome and strategic kind of goals are. So I just wanted to start with that, and then there may be some other components to tease out. But, you know, how do you see this sort of question of the U.S. and Israeli approaches in war and in strategy in this context?
Yeah, I mean, when we do war games theory and we try to analyze battles or movements and tactics and strategies of players in the field, it's very the number one thing that you need to ascertain before you begin your analysis is what is the primary strategic goal of one player. So in the situation of a Zionist colony, their primary strategic goal is permanency. They need the Zionist colony to become permanent. That's their primary strategic goal. And the primary strategic goal of the United States is to, in our region at least, is to remain the primary hegemon. Okay. And on a global scale, to remain such also. But even if we don't want to look on a global scale, the United States' primary strategic goal is to remain the undisputed hegemon. Okay. So now we understand what's their primary strategic goal, each of these players. We can lay out the tactics they may use to maintain, you know, to achieve that goal or maintain it, not have to change their strategic goal. And clearly, in both situations, there are only tactical maneuvers available for them to achieve their strategic goals is the subjugation, complete subjugation of the Arabic and Muslim peoples in the region, and or our complete eradication. There is no third tactical option in front of them to maintain those strategic goals. Okay, so once you understand that, then it becomes, you know, and you see that these two strategic goals of the Zionist colony and the empire, even if you want to pretend that they are different players, are actually the same. They cannot coexist without each other, then it becomes irrelevant to differentiate between the two players. Because, in fact, the Zionist colony cannot exist without the direct military intervention of the empire to sustain it. It cannot fight even the Palestinians by itself, let alone the resistance in Lebanon and or Iran. The Zionist colony is just a floating turd in our region, really. And it's only it's not all this bogus talk about Israel being so powerful and so untouchable and best of everything. It's actually all a delusion. This empire couldn't last one day since 1948. Without the direct intervention of the imperial powers behind them, okay? And similarly, right now, it's very clear to anybody that didn't understand the history of the region that the United States' presence in Western Asia and North Africa and East Africa and South Asia, right, and the Balkans and the Ukraine cannot be maintained if the United States is not able to maintain the Zionist colony as its main operational hub, where it punishes from it any uppity peoples in Asia and Africa and Eastern Europe. Okay? So the fate of the Zionist colony and the fate of the imperial hegemony in our region here are intertwined, and they cannot exist without each other. Therefore, there is no difference between the Zionist colony and the empire. Now, if the United States, as an empire, decided that it can remain one of the hegemons, not the only hegemon in the world. It can stay as a superpower if it abandons the Zionist colony and continue subjugating people in the rest of Africa, rest of Asia, and Latin America. It's clear that China and Russia will not be challenging the United States for hegemony over those regions. If it did abandon the Zionist colony, it can stay as an empire for at least another 100 years, another century. But as we see, the United States is refusing to change its strategic goal, which is this to be the sole hegemon, to change it to be one of the hegemons. Okay? And therefore, it is coupling the fate of the whole empire with the maintenance of this Zionist colony. It is illogical when you do it as a play it out as war games, okay, theory, but only if you don't include the theological and the racial and the supremacist attitudes of the governing class in the West. It would, if they were not supremacist to the point of thinking that they are the chosen people and that they have the right to eradicate Palestinians and colonize Judaism, Christianity, and Palestine and Islam, they would have abandoned the Zionist colony a while ago and maintained subjugation of other peoples. Okay, and their economy would have been great. They would have continued to claim that they are at the top of the food chain of humanity. But no, they're willing to burn all of that just to maintain the Zionist colony. And this is where anyone that doesn't understand this history and only plays the, puts the theories that are available to us, like, let's say, war games theory into action without putting those things into consideration, will not be able to realize why the hell is the United States going crazy like this.
Yeah, that's, I think, so important. I mean, the way I characterize it, and I think I've heard you also saying things that are very complementary and parallel to the kind of analysis I would say from a deep historical perspective, is that it's this kind of supremacist ideology that is part of like the whole Western Christian kind of civilization as a crusader Christendom, you know, that it has this compulsion that it developed from its deep earlier history of like having a universalist kind of domination and a particular kind of a vision of what that universalist domination should look like, that then, you know, it gets secularized and it's just part of, you know, colonial racism, but it's still the same structure of supremacism. And it is also kind of reflective of what we see with Jewish supremacy. And it is a clear, I mean, this is like so known and understood by people in the Middle East Islamic world, but yet, you know, Western historians or people in academia or people who have taken up in some ways maybe a secularist kind of framework of analysis, or I don't want to put it as that, but just not taking into account what you were just talking about, the ideological and cultural components that are also embedded in why it is that the West is such a genocidal kind of force. It's like they're wedded to that because they're wedded to this kind of vision of supremacist exclusion. And they can't imagine a world without that. You know, that's the problem for them. Otherwise, they could just, you know, go back to, as you're saying, you know, and there was even like some discussions, like in the new defense strategy released earlier last year in March, about a kind of new Monroe Doctrine, you know, kind of let's refocus on our primary area in the Western Hemisphere. But they can't really accept a world, you know, it seems, where other parts of the world could prosper, flourish, potentially challenge the, you know, universalist dominance of the West. Yeah, I don't know if you had any thoughts on that. Yeah.
You know, I think we had the conversation, me and you, maybe 18 years ago, I think, right?
Maybe.
We were talking about, you know, the did it start 600 years ago in 1492 with the fall of Granada and the invasion of the Americas, this psychosis that is in quote-unquote white minds. And at the time, you were referring to the beginnings of the Crusades as actually that. So it's a millennium, millennia, not a 6th series. And since that day, I've thought this out even more. And now I trace it back 6,000 years ago, mm-hmm. at the beginnings of the formation of European identity. And the formation of the first other in that, minds of Europeans, and meaning the Proto-Semitic tribes and nations of East and South Mediterranean. And, you know, once I traced it in my mind there historically, and you could see how, you know, the Greeks first invaded, looted the alphabet, looted the pantheon of the Canaanites, perverted it, and came back to the Canaanites to tell them, well, you can't worship Baal, you should be worshiping Zeus, okay, who's the same as Baal, really. And the mythology of him is exactly the same, the wife, the daughter, raping the daughter, whatever it is. It's all the same stories, repurposed by the Greeks and perverted, and then told to the indigenous people, you don't know your own God and your own mythology. I know it better than you. And then the Romans came after, did the same with Apollo and so forth. And then eventually the looting of Judaism and the looting of Christianity, and now the attempt to loot Islam, to pervert it. And every time in this storyline, it is the Europeans coming to us to tell us that we don't know our own theological heritage. We don't know even our own language, what it means. We are anti-Semites, although we're Semites, right? We don't know what really Christ was preaching, or Moses or Muhammad. They tell us what it is. We have to listen to them. And so it is an essential part of European identity, the looting of the theological heritage, cultural heritage of the East and South of the Mediterranean, and then the preaching to those peoples what they think is the true interpretations of these theological stories. Throughout this whole process, there was an attempt to create a monotone European culture that didn't exist before. There's Greeks, there's Latins, there's Germanics, there's Slavics, peoples that have different cultures and different languages, and they're trying to mold them into a monoculture against any logic of geography or culture or language. And that only increased and became more possible with the furnace of the colonial genocidal era in the Americas, where suddenly those European identities can be compressed into one and then juxtaposed against the red man and the black man. Okay, this white man that was just fabricated in North America, and now we're seeing the full circle coming. And so, throughout this process of 6,000 years, every time our peoples in the East and South of the Mediterranean have fought it and managed to defeat it, and this time it's not going to be different. Yes, it's going to be a higher cost, but in the end, we will be able to retain our cultures, our language, and control of them, and our theological heritage.
Yeah, inshallah. You know, I mean, that's very important to have this long durée kind of perspective, and it really helps. I mean, give a sense of confidence. You know, the 500-600 years of excessive hegemonic dominance of the West is a kind of departure from the main structure and course of human history. It's made some technological and various other kinds of accomplishments, but it only happened, you know, the way it happened. It's partly, as I've been kind of suggesting on some conversations, is, you know, because they were willing to use a certain kind of brutality and violence, colonial racial kind of violence and eradication in such an extreme way at a time where they started to develop, you know, some kind of technical advantage when it comes to making war, you know, that it kind of it jumped them into a position that was sort of a false position when you look at some of the material conditions of longer term geography, history, resources, and so on. And what we're seeing is going back in some ways, you know, to China being a very important, dominant part of the global economy, the West Asian region as so important geostrategically. You know, even before it had its oil resources, it was a very wealthy part of the world where urban civilization, you know, began, and all those developments you were talking about, you know, of the alphabet and, you know, all of these writing. And so, you know, there was all these developments, and there's a reason why it's happened there. It's because of its geography, its history, and the cultures that developed there over such a long period of time, you know. So, you know, we may be seeing a return to a more balanced kind of world in terms of overall development, where the natural advantages of societies in the East, where the greater population, where the better weather, where, you know, the longer growing season, like all these things that are part of the geography that is, you can't change that, you know. So we're returning to those kind of deeper sort of structures that gives people confidence, I think, you know, or should give people confidence that this is a phase that we're in, and maybe it's even towards the end. It doesn't mean that it's not going to be a bloody, brutal, because that's in fact what we see, all these decolonization. And in fact, I did want to ask you a little bit about this, because we're seeing in the tactics on, you know, Iran, you know, as it becomes less and less, I mean, very clear that they can't win this war, it leads to increased brutality, just like we saw in Gaza, just like we've seen in southern Lebanon, is that when the resistance is successful, it leads to more brutality and violence against the civilian population, and to try and destroy their infrastructure, their, you know, to deindustrialize if they can, or at least make it more painful, even as they know that they are losing and they will have to withdraw eventually. So that means we're going to see a lot of that pain. You know, I mean, you raised, and maybe this is something I also wanted to ask you about. You raised something about the last, you know, kind of 100 years. And in some ways, commentators have been talking a little bit about, you know, the whole Sykes-Picot colonial arrangement is up for grabs. And I think you've been discussing this. And it seems like what we're facing now is something like either a greater Israel project or a decolonized West Asia. And that's not going to look like the last, you know, 100 years or so, or the Sykes-Picot era. It's going to look differently. Is that some way that you see, you know, see this happening? And what do you think are the important lessons that come out of that history and that period as we're going forward now in this conflict?
Yeah, I mean, the easiest way to think about this is that following Sykes-Picot and the purposeful fragmentation of the Levant, for instance, cutting off Iraq from Syria, from Lebanon, from Palestine, from Jordan, and from lands that are now in south, what is now Turkey, that are part of the Levantian cultural basin, this, you know, took away from the Arabic people one of the most important cultural hubs of continuity, you know. And as we saw, because the Levant is so important, not only to Arabic history formation and having the first capital of the empire being Damascus or Baghdad the second, or having been the place where language ever first started or the birthplaces of the monotheistic religions, is, you know, this artificially raised the status of periphery parts of the Arabic world that are hardly populated and have no cultural, although they have some culture, I'm not trying to undermine anybody's culture, or have very little cultural significance output into Arabic identity. You know, say Bahrain. You know, maybe I can name one poet over the last 2,000 years in Arabic that came from Bahrain, okay? And so forth. So that is, again, so the unnatural situation of the Sykes Pico, even with those limitations, Syria was the first country on planet Earth to lead a armed revolution at the end of World War II and succeed in 1942, before even the Chinese succeeded in liberating what is to become the People's Republic of China. So that shows you how important it is. And what happened after is all these Arabic revolutions that overthrew the imperialist-appointed royal families that have nothing to do with the people, that are puppets and vassals. And there was an attempt to overthrow the remaining ones that didn't succeed, meaning Jordan, the Gulf countries, and Morocco. And since that point, the war of the empire has been, and the Zionists, is to destroy any Arabic countries that escaped the rule of the vassal regimes and the empire. And with the fall of Damascus in 2024, in January 2024, sorry, 25, the Zionists were living a euphoric moment. It was for the first time since 1942, every Arabic capital fell back under imperialist rule. 100 years of resistance to colonialism and imperialism in the region as just were wiped out as if they never happened. Okay? And in this moment of euphoria, the Zionists, outwardly started to say things that they've been hiding behind, like the idea of having a greater Israel that was supposed to happen anyways in 1912, 1917, but the valiant resistance of people of the Levant destroyed that project, and the independence of Syria, and then the withdrawal of the French from Lebanon, and then the collapse of the King of Jordan, all of those things stopped the greater Israel project between the two world wars, okay? So this is between and after the World War II. So this is where we are right now. The Zionists wanted, now they thought that all the Arabic republics fell back into their rule. They can build a greater Israel project. At the same time, what just happened is because there was no more Arabic capitals under independent governance, because all of them fell back to this imperialist clause, it became easier for the populations in places like Syria, who may have, some of them may have fell to the Wahhabi imperialist propaganda to cause the 15 years war on Syria, are right now waking up to see that the kingdoms in the Gulf are selling them and their daughters on the black market. And nothing good is going to come out from this. And this is why we're beginning to see revolts happening in Syria even, you know?
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought up the situation in Syria. And we did also have like a couple of comments in the chat, people wanting to know. And this was a topic I definitely wanted to ask you about, because, of course, we know December 2024, when there was the, you know, Takfiri jihadi takeover with the collusion of, you know, the usual suspects in the region, taking over and getting rid of one of the kind of governments, and we had a chance to talk about this one last time you were on, so not to review all of that, but then, you know, there was you know, it looked like they were trying to consolidate some kind of rulership over the country through their pogroms and massacres of, you know, other religious kind of communities, and then being recognized really by the Western powers as a legitimate kind of government. And wasn't he recently, you know, Al-Jolani, wasn't he recently in Germany conducting some kind of business? He's been feted at like the Munich Security Conference at this place, that place. But then now we've been seeing some interesting things happening, you know, with the passage of this law that just, like, nobody who's been watching any of what you've been saying or, you know, alternative media has any delusions, you know, like the fact that they passed some law about executing prisoners. You know, what it is obviously a response to the Al-Aqsa flood, right? I mean, it's like, okay, if that was designed around prisoner exchange and all of that, they're trying to just take this elimination approach. That's obviously going to change the dynamic. This has sparked all kinds of protests and movement, and even in Syria. So who is protesting? Why are they protesting so much about this? Why has this been a trigger for... within the context maybe of the overall Ramadan war that's been happening, but, you know, what's happening in Syria? This is such an interesting, and I don't think a lot of people have a good information, and I have not seen any real analysis about what's really happening in Syria. That's why one thing that really motivated me, I have to bring on Laith, because I need somebody who will clarify what's really going on in Syria.
Well, I think, just like how we were talking about the collapse of effect of imperialist media because of the successes of the resistance media, right now, anyone that was in Syria or in the Sunni Arabic populations in the Arabic world that were somehow fooled by Wahhabi and Gulf media that were claiming, let's say, the Axis of Resistance is just abusing Palestine, or that Iran and the U.S. are playing a game. And, well, you know, there was now a year and a half without Assad and in Syria, and we saw nothing improve. And not only that, the Zionists expanded. Not only that, we saw basically Al-Julani kiss the finger and the ring. And even anyone that thought he's some fundamentalist Sunni, we see him, you know, in the brothels and pubs of Europe and the West, and playing basketball and what have you. Okay, so it's the all the propaganda just collapsed because there was no opposition to it. There was nobody to blame anymore. You couldn't blame Assad anymore. Okay, so it's all done. And the Zionists are running rampant in Syria, beating up people, killing people, occupying more land. The American ambassador to the Zionist colony, you know, justifying the right to colonize all the Arabic people and killing them all and their children. So it is right now, there is no successful propaganda that can fool the people. And this war, where Iran and Lebanon and Yemen are now on day 38 of bashing the hell out of the Zionist colony and the United States and succeeding, all have motivated people to fully wake up in Syria. And we saw the first demonstrations coming out in Daraa, which is the province right on the border with Jordan, right on the border with the Golan Heights, which also supposedly the first demonstrations against Assad 15 years ago started. So it's very significant. Daraa and the Valley of Hauran, all the main tribes in North Jordan and in the Golan Heights, they're all related. This is very significant. And these people carried arms and went to the border of the Golan Heights and started shooting with their personal machine guns. That triggered demonstrations all around the country and a rush by Al-Julani and his regime to try to ride this wave and manipulate it somehow, partially to divert it to useless demonstrations, partially to gain some more points for Al-Julani, let's say, to squeeze the Europeans for more money, partially to follow the strategy of Erdogan, the sponsor of Al-Julani, who likes to yap a lot against Israel, then does nothing. That's Al-Julani, what he's doing right now with these demonstrations. But no matter what, Al-Julani doesn't control the vast majority of territory in Syria, and there is dormant resistance everywhere in every sect, including the Sunnis. And as we saw just in the last, yesterday or the day before, there was multiple missiles fired from Syria onto Israeli bases in the Golan Heights, coordinated with resistance from Lebanon and fire from Iran and Iraq. So there is right now clear beginnings of an armed uprising in Syria. We don't know how Al-Julani is going to deal with it, and or if it's going to be a big resistance. But even if it's just one bullet being fired from inside the Syrian territory onto the Golan Heights, this will trigger a reaction from the Zionists, which will require them to move big amounts of troops to defend the Golan Heights, which will in turn lift some pressure off Lebanon and off Gaza and off the West Bank. So the littlest possible resistance in Syria can have a very significant return for the whole battle in general. And I don't think the resistance in Syria is going to be small and insignificant. I think we will see in the next few days it's growing and things going out of control.
Okay, really interesting. I mean, so because I was wondering if some of these groups that have reformed themselves in resistance factions are those soldiers who just melted away, into the hills and mountainous kind of regions in the west, part of Syria, and from the National Army, and whether they're reconstituting, these are the people. I mean, we know it was different groups in the south there, close to Jolan, to the Golan Heights, etc. What do you think are the prospects for, because it's also, we heard and we remember that after HDS took over, there was repeated massive bombardment by Israel of known kind of military hardware stocks of the Syrian army and government to try and, absolutely wipe out any military potential threat, in the post, in the HDS era. And now they're also, once his usefulness looks like it's questionable, now there's even sort of threats. I wonder what you make of this, like Ben-Gvir saying, we have to, take out Jolani, now that they're maybe losing kind of control, they'll kind of frame it as like, oh, we have to fight terrorism there or something. I don't know. Like there's something interesting going on. I think a lot of groups are confused about how to handle this situation. It's unpredictable.
Well, the threats of Ben-Gvir against Al-Julani is really more directed towards Turkey because, Israel sees Turkey as the only competitor for them within the imperial structures to who is going to control the Levant. Okay? So this is really what it's about. It's not that Al-Julani is going to fight Israel. Now, in terms of the resistance that is now we're seeing
in 15 months, and we were told by a lot of propagandists, oh, just give him time, all this. He was always an agent, and now we're seeing it. But it's when the agent is no longer valuable in performing their role, then they're expendable, right?
So yes. So of course, if Al-Julani loses control of the country, they may kill him, the Zionists, because then they'll claim they did something by attacking a terrorist. But obviously, Erdogan will try to do anything he can to maintain Jordani's regime. Now, having said that, there's multiple kinds of and layers of resistance right now brewing in the country, Syria. So you have the remnants of the Syrian military that, as you mentioned, dissolved. And some of them actually went into Lebanon and went into Iraq with their equipment, with their heavy equipment, including tanks and so forth. So those are, I think, the most dormant of the possible resistance. It's not going to be the first thing that we see are tanks, former Syrian military tanks rolling in from Iraq. That's not going to be the first stage. There is also, of course, all the Shia, Alawi, and Druze, and Christian resistance that is been formulated prior to the fall of Assad's government. And since then, also, there's, of course, the Syrian Social Nationalist Party that has and had thousands of fighters inside Syria, defending Syria throughout the war, and they will be active somehow. And finally, just so we can understand how dire the situation is for the Wahhabi death squads and al-Jolani's regime, you have all these former ISIS and al-Qaeda and HTS fighters that are Syrian that have been abandoned financially since the takeover of Damascus. The Turkey, Qatar, Saudis, and Emiratis have been paying the salaries of mainly the foreign fighters that were given citizenship in Syria after the collapse of the Syrian government, because they see them as the most loyal to them, and have been not helping the economic situation in the country, and have fired most of the former Syrian fighters within ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and others. So as we saw maybe 2 months ago, even before the start of the war, there was a Syrian from a village that's close to the Golan Heights that got occupied by the Israelis on their way to Damascus, an area that is Beit Jinn is called the village. They occupied it, the Israelis, and this former HTS fighter, without any directives, without anybody telling him or anybody giving him money, just pulled his personal guns and killed Israeli soldiers that are passing through the village, right? So there is right now an uncontrollable situation of poverty, of people not satisfied with the rule, and all of these things that are explosive. And even former Al-Qaeda and ISIS soldiers could at any moment, without the okay of former leaders, turn their guns on the Zionist presence in the country.
Okay, really interesting. Laith, I don't know how much time you have if you have to go. There are a couple of other questions we could talk about, but it's up to you in the time that you have.
I do have another call. Yeah. So I will have to let you go. I'm sorry, but usually
no, all right. You've been very generous. We will hopefully, inshallah, have you back on sooner than the last time for updates and more on like Yemen, Lebanon, Iraq, etc. But we had a good historical discussion too, and those are so fun. So I really thank you so much for taking the time and joining us here, and everyone in the stream. Please, join me in thanking Laith, and we wish him all the best safety, inshallah, and continued support for the work that he's doing. So do check out the links in the description and support Free Palestine TV, the on-the-ground reporting from the front lines, as well as the extraordinary analysis and other shows. Jazakallah, Laith. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Adnan, and inshallah we'll see you soon again. I'm here for you and your blog anytime.
Okay. Shukran. Okay. Peace, solidarity to you all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.